anytime they claim we don't hold people accountable, that's just not true. We have the facts to demonstrate it, and we're going to continue doing that. But everyone is entitled to due process, even law enforcement. Every single person we detain, we arrest, they're entitled to due process. We're going to ensure that. Every time someone dies in an office-involved shooting, the deceased is entitled to that due process as well. We're going to ensure that.
LA County Sheriff Alex Villanueva yesterday defending his department after sheriff's deputies shot and killed a 29-year-old man named Dijon Kizzy in South LA Monday. He is the second man killed by sheriff's deputies in that neighborhood in the last 3 months. Kizzy was riding a bicycle when deputies tried to stop him for violating vehicle codes. Joining me now is Ruben Vives, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, the Times, your paper obtained some video footage of this incident. What does it show?
Well, it shows, it's very hard to see, but it shows Dijon walking, at least being confronted by deputies. There is a scuffle that breaks out, and then shortly you see the two deputies opening fire on Dijon. That's pretty much the video.
How many shots were fired?
Well, we know that from another video footage that we received from a neighbor who, from their doorbell, their door ring, counted about 15 gunshots. Of course, 15 gunshots were heard on that particular video. And we are, of course, waiting on the coroner and LA Sheriff's Department to come out with their own, obviously, facts about the shooting.
So what do we know now? I know there are still a lot of things we don't know, but what is the general outline of what happened? He was riding a bicycle and officers tried to stop him?
Yeah, pretty much on Monday afternoon, two deputies spotted him. He was riding a bicycle. They say that he violated some vehicle codes, although the department has yet to say what code specifically. They tried to talk to him or approach him, I guess, and he dropped the bicycle, ran off. They chased after him, and then he turned on 109th Place, which is the Westmont neighborhood area that I'm speaking about, and tried to stop him again. And that is when, as I described from the grainy video that we've obtained, it shows the deputies running up to him, and, you know, there's a scuffle that breaks out. He drops a bundle of clothes. There's a gun that falls out, according to the sheriff's department, and that's what led them to open fire.
That last bit of evidence, the gun, that's in dispute, right? Because some witnesses said they didn't see a gun.
Yeah, I mean, there's also the sheriff's department also says that Dijon punched a deputy. There are witnesses who were watching the altercation happen, saying that never happened. They're raising concerns. They're raising questions about whether there was a gun there, and if there was, did he actually have it? Did he actually point it at deputies? They're just, the main thing is that was deadly force even necessary? Could have this been prevented by handling it in a whole non-lethal way.
Right. And so there have been protests since this happened on Monday. One of the areas of concern is that his body was left there in the street for many, many hours, right?
Yes. I mean, one thing that I, speaking to residents yesterday, what was sort of telling was that, you know, there were no paramedics called. In fact, one neighbor told me that it took about 5 minutes for them to even approach Dijon's body and then handcuffed him. This is all after the shooting. So he's laying there. 5 minutes go by. They finally handcuff him and then that's it, you know, and then the investigation into the shooting happens. I'm not sure if they determined whether he was had died at that point or not, but, you know, just those facts alone are very disturbing to hear.
You know, handcuffing him after shooting maybe a dozen rounds.
Well, I mean, there are protocols that the sheriff's department has to follow, but just not even calling paramedics even within that time frame is what was pretty disturbing to hear from residents. Obviously, this has left them very upset. They're calling for, again, they're criticizing the sheriff's department. They're calling for body cameras to be equipped on these deputies. And that's why you're seeing these protests happening.
So the sheriff's deputies were not wearing body cams?
They were not, no.
All right. Still a lot of questions about this incident. I want to thank you so much for updating us.
Of course. Thank you.
That's Ruben Vives, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Well, as we touched on yesterday, several police reform bills await Governor Gavin Newsom's signature. One requires the Attorney General to investigate fatal police shootings of unarmed civilians. Another bans the use of chokeholds and neck restraints, like the kind that led to George Floyd's death in Minneapolis. But there were sweeping measures that failed. And here to tell us why is Laurel Rosenhall, who's been covering this for Cal Matters. Hi.
Hi.
Well, we were just talking about this police shooting in South L.A. that happened on Monday. Is that the kind of shooting that would be investigated under the bill that is on the governor's desk that would require the state to look into fatal shootings of unarmed civilians?
Yes, but when it takes effect is really the big question that you have to contend with here, because under this bill, the new program of having a state level investigation of a police shooting will only actually happen when the legislature puts money into it. And it's a new responsibility for the state government to take on. And so therefore they have to find some budget to do it. And this bill does not have any funding attached.
So if they don't, it's toothless.
Yes. The whole thing is dependent on getting funding. And I do think that, you know, the more power that the Black Lives Matter movement gets, that the more pressure there is to do something like this. And it's possible that they would allocate money in next year's budget. But there is also the major constraints of the state budget that are related to the pandemic and the recession that we're now in. So there's a lot of demands for funding and a lot less tax revenue than there used to be.
And then banning the chokeholds, a lot of police departments already do that. So how important was that piece of legislation?
Well, you know, for supporters, they say that this will make a statewide policy. And it's true that even though a lot of departments already prohibit that practice, there's a lot of different police agencies in California. It's a very big state. And some of them are small, don't have, you know, a ton of oversight. And so this will ban the practice statewide and make a more uniform policy across the state. But it's not probably at the scale of change that many activists were hoping for, since that is already in place in a lot of big cities.
So during the protests and in the immediate aftermath, the protests after George Floyd's shooting, a lot of people had pressed for big changes. And one of those big changes would have been the idea that police officers, if they were involved in these kinds of deaths, could be decertified by a state agency. That did not pass. Why not?
Yeah, that was actually like the most controversial of all of the proposals. That was the one that the police were fighting against the most. And that is something that where California, frankly, really lags the rest of the country. And police fought against that. They really did not like the particulars of this bill. The bill language also got into areas of qualified immunity. And the police lobby says they do want a decertification system and that they want to negotiate something with the legislature. And so I expect this issue will be back next year. But what they're really looking for is something that's going to be more similar across the country. They say they want a system that is going to, you know, guarantee them their due process rights and not be wildly different from one state to the next.
That was a bill that had a lot of supporters, though. So it's a little surprising that it died in the Democratic-controlled legislature, which has a supermajority. I mean, Kim Kardashian West lobbied for it.
Yeah, the legislature is controlled by Democrats, and also the police have a lot of influence. Both of those things are true. And I think that the sort of classic criticism is related to campaign finance and the funding that Democrats get from police unions. That's absolutely true. They are very consistent donors to both the California Democratic Party and the California Republican Party. They get involved in a lot of political campaigns in the legislature, but I think their influence is even greater than the money. You got to think about who becomes a legislator. A lot of the people who become legislators in Sacramento have come up through local politics in their own community. Maybe they were a district attorney. Maybe they were on their city council or their board of supervisors. They get to Sacramento and they have really close ties to the local governments in the communities they represent. And so they have relationships with police and prosecutors. They are colleagues. And so the influence is not only money, it's also related to the professional environment that both law enforcement and legislators come out of.
Interesting. What about the bill, though, that would have prohibited police from using tear gas or rubber bullets on demonstrators? That doesn't seem as controversial.
Yeah. And, you know, the police were opposed to that one because they said that that would leave them with, frankly, just more dangerous options. The police union representative I spoke with this week said that would leave them basically with their nightsticks or their guns for dispersing unlawful crowds. So they don't like the idea of losing the ability to use what they call less lethal weapons in these crowd situations. And they made the argument that that would force them to have to use their guns even more.
Well, they do use their nightsticks. We've seen a lot of footage of police beating protesters or brandishing their nightsticks at protesters.
Yeah, I won't be surprised if a lot of these bills come back next year. You've got to keep in mind that not only was this the year of George Floyd's killing and the really nationwide rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, but obviously it was also the year of the pandemic, and that interrupted and disrupted the normal functioning of the legislature tremendously. There was a huge pause in the process this spring when the legislature basically went on hiatus for 2 months. That's the season when a lot of bills normally would go through these lengthy committee hearings and really be hashed out kind of in public debate. When they came back, there was all these new procedures. There was a lot less public participation in the Capitol because of the coronavirus and limitations. It was harder both for activists to show up and also harder for legislators to really dig into these long, complicated issues. And it was harder for two sides, the police side and the civil rights side, to have any opportunity for like an in-person negotiation. So I think that hampered a lot of the police reform agenda. And what we don't know is how much next year's legislative session is going to be stymied in the same way as we saw this year, or whether, hopefully, God willing, the pandemic will begin to subside and we can all get back to more normal life.
That would be quite nice. That would be great. Thank you. Laurel Rosenhall from Cal Matters. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, why some people are doubting the official COVID death count. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. More than 180,000 Americans have died of COVID-19. The CDC says nearly all of them, about 94%, had other health problems that may have contributed to their deaths. But COVID skeptics have used that data point to suggest that the actual death toll from the disease is a lot lower. Some of them have political reasons to downplay the seriousness of the pandemic here, but it may not be politics alone. Joining me now to talk about this is Alan Jern. He's a cognitive scientist and associate professor of psychology at the Rose Holman Institute of Technology in Indiana. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So when someone with existing health problems, say diabetes, catches COVID and later dies, COVID is still the official cause of death, right?
That's my understanding. I guess assigning cause of death on these death certificates is a complicated matter, but you can assign sort of an acute cause of death and contributing causes. And at least that's my understanding. So that may be sort of the acute cause of death, and these underlying diseases might be contributing causes.
So you've written an article in Vox, and you talk about something called counterfactual thinking when it comes to this, kind of addressing this idea that some people are taking this figure that I cited, the CDC figure of comorbidity, and saying, well, that means coronavirus is not as deadly as we thought it was. What leads to that kind of thinking?
Yeah, so you mentioned counterfactual thinking. So when people make this claim that, you know, somebody who had heart disease died of COVID, they'll often say, like, well, this person would have died anyway if they didn't get COVID. And that's counterfactual thinking in the sense that they're imagining a situation or a world in which they didn't get COVID. And would the outcome be the same? They're claiming the answer is no. Ordinarily, counterfactual thinking is a really valuable tool that we all rely on for reasoning about causes and effects. But this is a case where some people who are relying on counterfactual thinking, it's that kind of thinking is breaking down. And one important reason is that they're applying it, our intuitive way of applying counterfactual thinking, they're applying it to a complex system involving complex causal relationships about the human body, about causes of death. And simple applications of counterfactual thinking may not hold up here.
Well, so they're saying, well, look, let's say this person had advanced heart disease and died. They're saying, well, what's to say that he wouldn't or she wouldn't have died from the heart disease anyway? So
exactly.
And if someone who is relatively healthy and doesn't have this underlying health condition might have survived this or would be a lot more likely to have survived this. So why not say that this person did die of heart disease?
So making those judgments, that's up to the medical experts. People who make this claim are inclined to attribute cause of death, or inclined to disregard the expert judgments and attribute causes of death to, say, heart disease versus COVID-19. I mean, they're faced with a situation where they hear that there are these two potential causes of death, and either one, could have been a cause. But one of those, say, heart disease, that's something that's really familiar to people. We know that people can die of heart disease. We've heard countless cases of that. COVID is a new disease. We know comparatively little about it, and you know how it causes people to die is much less clear. And so the mechanism by which these two different diseases can kill people are very different. And so when people are engaging in this kind of counterfactual thinking, the one potential cause, like heart disease, where there's a clear causal mechanism, looks like a more attractive cause. So let me describe a study where they actually tested this out. So in a study by psychologists Claire Walsh and Stephen Sloman, they presented people with situations like this, where there were these two potential causes. One of them, there was a clear mechanism. Actually, it was throwing a rock through a window. So somebody threw a rock. It's pretty clear how that would cause the window to break. The other potential cause is somebody was standing between the rock and the window, and they stepped out of the way. So normally, there wouldn't be a clear mechanism between stepping aside and causing a window to break. And from a counterfactual perspective, both of those two causes were responsible for the window breaking, because if either one of those things didn't happen, the window wouldn't have broken. But people were much more likely to judge the person who threw the rock to be a cause than the person stepping aside. And it's possible that when people are thinking about COVID-19 causes of death, they're applying the same kind of heuristic. They're thinking, well, heart disease, that makes a lot of sense. I understand how that causes death. COVID-19 makes a lot less sense.
Although in that case, I would assign COVID-19 to the rock thrower because that's the animating incident. And the secondary incident, secondary cause would be the heart disease, which would be the person standing or not standing in the way.
Sure, right. So you're thinking about it, I guess, from the standpoint of someone who already understands sort of the expert judgment. So that's related to another point here, which is that I guess you could claim that some of these people are not reasoning in good faith. But another possibility is that, well, they're of course not experts to begin with, but they are engaging in what's known as motivated reasoning. So these people who make these claims generally are not just completely neutral with respect to their views on the reality of the pandemic and COVID. Most of these people probably are skeptical for other reasons, and they are then predisposed to look for reasons to doubt what's going on and to doubt the official death tolls. And so this heuristic, this kind of causal reasoning heuristic, is something that we all use sometimes, but this is something that's available to people who want to doubt the pandemic if they want to find a reason to doubt what's going on.
Alan Jern is a cognitive scientist at the Rose Holman Institute of Technology in Terre Haute, Indiana. Alan, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, how much can teachers talk about Black Lives Matter? Lessons from the Jim Crow era.
We were teaching American history and civics and telling our students that they should grow into first-class citizens when we were not even registered to vote.
How race and power are taught to school children, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. For decades, there has been a tug of war going on in our classrooms over which version of history kids are taught and how they're taught it. School teachers can help shape the mind, the ideology, and sometimes the values of a child. And that causes sometimes a lot of consternation. In this moment, we are having a national reckoning over Black people being killed by police. So what is the role of the school teacher when it comes to that subject? Joining me now is Tondra Loader Jackson. She's a professor of educational foundations at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and she's researched the role educators played in the civil rights movement. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, what brings this to mind is a story that broke last week, and we talked about it on the show, where a ninth grade teacher in Woodland Hills, she attended a social justice development workshop at her school to, you know, discuss how to talk about this stuff with her kids. And she wore an I Can't Breathe t-shirt to class. And this is a Zoom class. So the kids were at home watching over video. The parent of one of the kids complained and said, well, the father, he basically took a photo of the teacher as she was teaching, and he complained and said he wanted his daughter to learn English in her English class. So what do you make of that anecdote and what it says about this particular moment and the role that teachers should or should not play teaching it?
I'll say, as a teacher educator, it's very painful to witness what this teacher and her daughter are going through, especially the death threats and disruption in their home life. I understand, all in the midst of a pandemic. And I must say that similar situations have occurred with other teachers. Several days ago, an advanced English high school teacher in Texas who posted Black Lives Matter and LGBTQ posters in her virtual classroom. I refer to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer posters in her virtual classroom. Apparently, these were the same types of posters she posted when she was in the physical classroom. She was placed on leave after parents complained. And about 4 years ago, you had a substitute teacher in Fresno, California, who wore a Black Lives Matter button to school and was told a day later that he could no longer work at that school because he was in violation of the school's policy on being neutral on political matters. Mm-hmm. We can expect to see more situations like these, and this is not new when you look at the history of teacher activism in this country, especially since the mid-20th century phase of what some historians prefer to call a long civil rights movement, because we're certainly in the midst of another phase of this movement. And I can speak to the history of Black teacher activism, in particular in the South, primarily in Alabama.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. So are Black teachers treated differently than white teachers when it comes to this? Are white teachers allowed more leeway when it comes to expressing their political beliefs?
It's interesting that you would ask that, because the two examples I gave you, at least one of the two examples I gave you, the substitute teacher who wasn't called back, that was a 75-year-old white male teacher. I don't know the race and ethnicity of the teacher in Texas, but I'm not certain that she was African-American. So I wouldn't make a blanket statement about how Black teachers versus white teachers are being treated on this particular matter, but certainly historically, yes, they've had their lives threatened when they took stands for their students or for voting rights and other issues.
It's so interesting because, you know, obviously when we're talking about civil rights, and you mentioned that this is not past history, and it is not. We're in a civil rights movement right now, that if you are a Black teacher or a person of color, you are living that history. And so how can you avoid not talking about it and being sort of the personification of what you're teaching to your students?
That's a good point. Now, there are teachers who do avoid talking about race, Black and otherwise. So it can be done, but there are many teachers who do believe that as a part of their racial identity and heritage, it is important to address these issues.
During the civil rights movement, how did teachers teach and how did they address the moment, let's say after Martin Luther King Jr. was shot or Bobby Kennedy? Like how were those really pivotal, dramatic moments taught in classrooms?
First, I think it's important to underscore that the mere identity of being a Black teacher in the Jim Crow South was threatening to white people. There is a record of a Black teacher in Jefferson County, Alabama, and that's the county seat for Birmingham. Her name was Elizabeth Lawrence, who was actually lynched in 1933 for reprimanding white children who were being rude to her while she was walking home. So therefore, any teacher who would dare go beyond what this teacher did would certainly be endangered in that particular era. There actually is a fable or a myth in civil rights history and folklore that Black teachers were not involved in the movement. Some of this misconception relates to the actions of some school administrators, some principals, some Black college presidents who acquiesced to the demands of the white power structure by forbidding their students and faculty from protesting or threatening to discipline or fire them if they did. And so although that was the case for some Black administrators, but certainly not all of them, there are examples of many more teachers who were activists. Now in Alabama, there is a little known story about the Selma Teachers March. And that march actually preceded the Selma to Montgomery March, or what we've come to know today as Bloody Sunday, especially with our recent memorials of Congressman John Lewis. There was one unsung teacher activist, Reverend Frederick D. Reese, and he headed the Selma Teachers Association. He mobilized more than 100 teachers in January 1965 to march from Clark Elementary School to the Dallas County Courthouse to register to vote. And some of those teachers returned to march in Bloody Sunday. One of those teachers, her name is Sally Serency Jackson. She reflected on what was going on during that time during a panel at Auburn University in the state of Alabama. She said, "It seemed wrong to us as leaders in the community that we were teaching American history and civics and telling our students that they should grow into first-class citizens when we were not even registered to vote. We did not enjoy full citizenship." And she said, "In one case, I remember a janitor was registered, but I was not. It was embarrassing."
So now that we are having another conversation about voting rights, and it's just so palpable, I'm wondering how you think teachers should address the current debate over voting rights and mail-in voting and all that with their students.
A teacher's primary role is to educate students. So, and drawing on as much quality content as they can about the suffrage movement. This is certainly the year to do that, given that centennial, I think is very important. There are teachers who do get involved with voters registration. Some of them choose to do that on their own time. If a school works together with its school district, and it's very important when teachers engage in any kind of a political or civic activity to check with their school districts, with their school administrators about what the parameters are of doing that. Just to link this back to the history of teacher activism, that was a key form of activism for teachers during the civil rights movement, was to engage in voter education. There's one teacher in Birmingham, Ruth Bearfield Pendleton, who in the mid 60s, when she went to register to vote, and at that time she would have had to take a test, she actually, in her words, she smuggled a copy of the questions, brought them to her classroom, and distributed them to her students so that they could share them with their parents and prepare for the tests. There is that history of teacher involvement at that level.
But do you think that that should be extended to today? Should there? I mean, it seems like teachers and who is teaching what to whom is under even more scrutiny, especially with kids learning at home and their parents over their shoulders.
You make a good point. I know in the Alabama course of study, in social studies course of study, there is a provision for teaching about suffrage, about voter education. As long as teachers are really looking at the curriculum for their state and for their school, they have they're working closely with their administrators on developing that content, they certainly should be addressing these issues.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Tondra Loader-Jackson, professor of educational foundations at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and she's author of the book Schoolhouse Activists, African-American Educators and the Long Birmingham Civil Rights Movement. Coming up, Pepe the Frog was conceived as just a dumb party animal, but he has become a potent political symbol and may have helped Donald Trump win the presidency. That story next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Pepe the Frog, an anthropomorphic cartoon amphibian with exaggerated features and the sarcastic smirk of someone who knows something you do not. Well, for years, the popular internet memes circulated on message boards like Tumblr, Reddit, and 4chan. The alt-right adopted him and attached him to Donald Trump when he was running for president. And the Anti-Defamation League eventually classified Pepe as a hate symbol. It is one of the odder sidebars to the story of Trump's political rise and his brand of populist nationalism. Filmmaker Arthur Jones' new documentary tells the story of Pepe the Frog and the guy who originally created him, cartoonist Matt Fury, and how this took him on a really, really wild ride. The movie's called Feels Good Man, and it's out this Friday on demand. Arthur Jones joins me now. Hi.
Hi. Great to be on.
Well, it's great to have you. So take us back to the beginning, and this very gentle cartoonist, Matt Fury, he seems to be the exact opposite of what has happened to Pepe. How did he create Pepe to begin with?
Well, Matt created Pepe in the mid-2000s, and at the time he was working at the community thrift store in the San Francisco Mission. And so Matt's job at the community thrift store was to sort through all the toys that had been donated. And he started drawing the Boys Club comic book while sorting through all those toys. And if you look at the characters that are in Boys Club, they sort of feel like nostalgic in a way that like an old discarded toy might. They're reminiscent of the Muppets. They're reminiscent of the Neverending Story. They look like things that are just kind of from the late 80s or early 90s. And he basically made it to entertain his friends.
Yeah, so he explains Pepe, the name, actually comes from Pee-pee.
Yes.
This is like, yeah. Says it all right there.
You know, Matt created this thing when he was in his early to mid 20s. And it, you know, now when we're catching him, you know, in the film, he's 40 and he's trying to figure out like how to reconcile this thing that he thought, you know, is kind of like long forgotten in his personal history.
And the phrase "feels good, man," which is the title of your movie, that was a phrase that was associated with Pepe. Why?
So the name of the film is Feels Good Man, like you said, and that's a very specific catchphrase. So in issue 2 of Boys Club, there's a one-page comic. And in that comic, Pepe is going to the bathroom. He's peeing standing up, but he's pulled his shorts down all the way around his feet. So they're sitting on the bathroom floor. And one of his roommates basically walks in on him and interrupts and is like, oh, sorry. And then after Pepe comes out of the bathroom, a roommate makes fun of him for peeing with his pants pulled all the way down around his ankles. And Pepe says, feels good, man. And that became a reaction image for people online in probably around like 2008, 2009. And then people started to change it. It went from feels good, man, to feels bad, man, to feels sad, man. You know, it really just became like a very early internet emoji.
So all of that is innocent and kind of illustrates how innocent the early version of the internet was. Mm-hmm. It's just a frog. It's just about feeling good, man. It's cute and kind of juvenile and whatever. But then it has morphed into something completely different. So how did Pepe make his way into the darker corners of the internet?
You know, it's funny, my personal take on it is maybe a little long-winded, but is the image of the sad frog, it's not the feels good man version of Pepe. There's a second image that was taken by the internet where Pepe is just looking sad. And that's taken from a page of Matt's comic. And in that comic, Pepe is eating a pizza-flavored bagel. And the pizza-flavored bagel makes him sad. And it's a very simple thing, but it's weird because it's really sort of this like moment where Pepe is feeling dissatisfied with the consumer culture that's around him. He's eating the pizza bagel. Initially, he's excited about this like pizza bagel. And then he eats it and is like, oh, this is disgusting. It's filled with additives. It's kind of gross. And I think there's kind of like this, you know, Matt calls it the garbage world in the movie. There's something about Pepe that seems like he is just kind of like from the consumer culture that we all feel trapped within. You know, there's a part of that culture that does satisfy us. It gives us like entertainment and junk food. But there's part of us that also just feels kind of like sick to our stomach about it.
That's interesting. Well, that would make sense because when you think of the people who adopted him, they seem to have given up on this culture as being something that can actually satisfy them. They've retreated into 4chan. They've retreated to their rooms or their mother's basements or what have you, into this dark place.
Yeah, it's a mixture of people retreating, but then those same people also feeling like a real sense of entitlement. Like they feel like that from a previous generation, they would have had a different set of options, like an easy job out of high school that wouldn't have been hard to get. They feel like they would be able to like get a girl pretty easily because you don't have all these women competing for attention on dating apps. You know, there's people have a lot more options now. So, you know, a lot of that feeling where they feel is basically like culture has been stolen from them is the exact same feeling that the older generation feels that has been listening to AM radio and they've been, you know, hearing from like Rush Limbaugh and, you know, Sean Hannity and Michael Savage that, you know, America has been stolen. And there was a feeling by this group of people who had been really immersed in the internet. They'd grown up extremely online that all of a sudden, all of these people who were not of the internet were now coming to the internet and using it. And they were very protective about Pepe. And so what they had tried to do initially was to make Pepe as extreme as possible so that it wouldn't be co-opted by people from the outside who might want to use it on Facebook or Tumblr or these other places. And there's always been this sort of like joke within 4chan to Nazify things. There are people on 4chan who identify obviously with that sort of fascistic worldview. But I think initially when it started, it was a joke because they just wanted to make Pepe seem like edgy and repulsive to people. But then people started to take that joke seriously. And then it became propaganda in 2015 and 2016 by people who recognized the popularity of the character and saw the edginess as a great way to obfuscate their intentions. So you had people like Richard Spencer using him. You had Donald Trump retweeting himself pictured as Pepe. Pepe with like the yellow hair standing behind like a podium. So yeah, it's a long, twisty journey that, you know, is only could happen online.
Right. And you do a great job in the movie unraveling that and also capturing Matt's befuddlement at how his innocent little frog creation became this worldwide alt-right hate meme.
Yeah.
How did he emotionally handle that?
You know, initially when Pepe jumped out of the Boys Club comics and into the internet, it was a pretty innocent meme, and Matt viewed it with just kind of like a certain amount. He was baffled by it, but he really kind of was inspired by Jerry Garcia's attitude towards people who recorded and then tape traded Grateful Dead shows. Matt had a very like, well, if people like Pepe, they're going to use Pepe, they're going to remix Pepe. I have no control over it. And then he assumed that like the internet was going to get sick of Pepe the way the internet gets sick of most things. But strangely enough, Pepe has stuck around now for over 10 years. You know, it's outlasted MySpace. It's outlasted Tumblr to a certain extent. It hasn't gone away as a character. It's kind of become the mascot for the internet.
So Pepe was adopted by all these incels and guys who like to hang out in their basement and hang out on 4chan. And then Donald Trump goes down that escalator and they think, oh, this is Pepe? This is the candidate for Pepe? Like, how did they decide to attach Pepe to Donald Trump?
When Donald Trump became a candidate, he initially seemed like basically he was a troll. And they saw a like-minded person. They found him to be funny. They found him to be ridiculous. They found him to be amoral. And so that became like a really potent symbol as this group of people went from thinking Donald Trump was a joke, trolly candidate to actually being like a viable chaos sower and presidential candidate. Pepe just became like this mascot that just became more and more ingrained in that form of communication. So it jumped off of 4chan and then it trickled out into places like Twitter, which obviously Trump has used to get his message out from the very beginning.
So during the campaign, it became a thing, this Pepe alt-right meme, and even Hillary Clinton addressed it. And I just want to play a clip of tape where there's someone in the audience who shouts Pepe. And this is from August of 2016.
These are racist ideas, race-baiting ideas, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, anti-women, all key tenets making up the emerging racist ideology known as the alt-right. Now, alt-right is short for alternative right.
So there you hear someone in the audience yell Pepe. Mm-hmm. What was going on there?
The guy that did that was live streaming on Periscope. Basically, he had posted onto 4chan asking people what he should yell. And he's looking at his phone and seeing different people egg him on. And so people are saying, you know, shout MAGA, shout a variety of offensive things. And someone says, shout Pepe. And he does. And it was a real moment of kind of satisfaction for trolls. People who are part of trolling raids on 4chan have always felt like that sort of mainstream media validation is like a gift to them. That feels like a real moment of like celebration.
And then this same group of people and more, they exult over Donald Trump winning the presidency. And they think that they did it, that they elected him. How accurate is that? I mean, how big a role? Of course, there are lots of different reasons why Donald Trump was elected president. But how big a role did this group of people play, these Pepe people?
Sure. I mean, that's debatable. I think the thing that these memes did ultimately was really galvanize Trump's base in a very powerful way. And they feel like they're part of the fun.
So they don't care about the effects. They just want the immediate visceral feeling of victory, of triggering, trolling people, owning the libs.
You know, I can't speak for everyone's intentions, obviously, especially when you're dealing with a message board where most people are anonymous. But I think owning the libs was like a huge part of it. You know, Trump supporters are a very angry group of people. It's the politics of aggrievement. And Pepe makes that aggrievement feel like fun and lighthearted rather than like diabolical or irrational.
I mean, it's so far from Matt's original creation. And did he think, well, okay, this is so far out of my control, I just have to let it go? Or did he want to rein it back in and take Pepe back?
I mean, taking Pepe back is something that I think, you know, Matt's a smart guy. He understands that, like, the internet is not something that he can take on its own. And there's a part of him that isn't emotionally invested in, like, needing to, like, control Pepe. But I think, honestly, when that stuff was happening, Matt was a new father. He was more preoccupied with providing for his family and dealing with a newborn than, like, fighting the alt-right. So, and I think that's very understandable. The sort of like straw that broke the camel's back that was there was a self-published kids book that someone had made where they used Pepe as the central figure in this Islamophobic kids book. And Matt's made a kids book. He had a young daughter and he felt that like people making propaganda directed at children was particularly offensive. So that was the moment where he sought to enforce his copyright.
It is really interesting that this frog of all characters has taken on such a huge life and means so much to so many people.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean, just looking at it, why do you think that is just from a visual standpoint?
Well, it's funny. We asked every single person we interviewed that question and no one really gave us an answer that seemed correct. There's not really a good answer for it. I think Pepe appeals to people because there's a certain sort of like innocence to the character. I think it is nostalgic because it does feel like like a discarded toy from the 1980s or something. I think also the fact that Pepe has like there's a slight sort of, he rides the line between cute and creepy. And I think that that's like has a really kind of like unique appeal to people. Also, as a cartoonist, I have to say there's something really potent about Pepe. People who are not cartoonists don't necessarily think about, like, oh, this cartoon is well drawn and this cartoon isn't. But there's certain cartoons, for example, like Betty Boop. People don't watch Betty Boop cartoons anymore, but the image of Betty Boop is still incredibly popular on clothing, in pop culture. And I think Pepe is just a really unique, well-drawn character that's easy for people to redraw. And there, it just has like a stickiness to it that's kind of hard to describe. And so, yeah, for whatever reason, it's just kind of like cemented into the cultural consciousness. So, you know, it is a stoned cartoon frog, but it's also a serious way in which we communicate. So, you know, the stuff that's initially seems easily dismissed is actually really negatively affecting our culture and kind of actively tearing us apart. And it's, I feel like if it's just something we all can think about and understand in a more complete way, that we're all going to be better equipped to deal with it.
Well, Arthur, thank you so much. This was really fascinating.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Arthur Jones, he's the director of the new documentary Feels Good Man. It's about Pepe the Frog and cartoonist Matt Fury. And it comes out this Friday, September 4th, available on demand and on digital platforms. And that does it for us today at Press Play. Press Pep Play? Anyway, I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks so much, and I will see you tomorrow.